Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I am Charlie Sykes. It is Wednesday. I had to double check that because we are living in this time-space continuum here. Our guest today is David Korn, the Washington Bureau Chief at Mother Jones, an analyst for MSNBC, also writes a newsletter, which I strongly recommend, called Our Land. And you can find his work at davidkorn.com. So welcome to the podcast, David.
It's an honor to be with you, Charlie, on this Bulwark Podcast.
Now, it sounds like you're actually becoming kind of entrepreneurial. You're becoming a capitalist here with the newsletter. And
ever since fourth grade, when I started delivering newspapers in Westchester County, I've always been a capitalist. I mean, I've always been an entrepreneur, but I'm a European social democrat. I want to make sure that capitalism works for as many people as possible, and for those who it doesn't work for, we help them out when they need it.
Okay, so the word on the street is that you are like in junior achievement, actually.
I was the Westchester County junior achiever in high school. It was a big controversial, and there were a lot of rules along the way. I'm not proud of it, but I did win the trophy, and I got to meet Chevy Chase because of that.
Okay, so that is cool. I feel like we've broken a major story here. It is possible. Look, I want to talk about your big scoop about the Russian media being told is essential to feature Tucker Carlson. But before we do that, could we just wallow in the Mo Brooks story for a moment? A little bit of background. Mo Brooks is the extremely Trumpy MAGA congressman from Alabama who actually spoke at the January 6th rally, saying that we should go kick ass. I think he was wearing a bulletproof vest. Is that right, David? I mean, he was all in.
Yeah, was one of the rabble rousers. He was one of the rousierist.
Right. I mean, he is like right there to the limit. And he's running for Senate in Alabama. And with Donald Trump's endorsement, Donald Trump enthusiastically endorsed Mo Brooks. And until this morning, Donald Trump threw him under the bus in just the most fabulous way. Look, I don't want to make this mysterious what happened here. Mo Brooks at one time was 44 percentage points ahead, and Trump loves winners. His campaign has been floundering despite the Trump endorsement, and Trump hates losers. And so he just dropped him from a great height. I'm sorry. It's one of those moments about, you buy the ticket, you take the ride. Mo Brooks learning a little bit about Trumpian loyalty going only one way, right?
Well, it's become a cliche to call the GOP a Trump cult. Oh. But this is what happens. It's Stalinistic, actually. It's all about the leader. And if you do anything that upsets the leader, you become a non-person. In the old Soviet Union, they took you out of the photos. They put you in jail. In this case, Mo Brooks said something like, I think it's time to get past the 2020 election. Like, let's just forget about it and move on. And in the Trump cult, the thing that matters most right now, of the top 10 things in the Trump cult, 1 through 10 are challenging the 2020 election and reinforcing the big lie that Trump won. If you don't do that, you don't get to stay in the Trump cult. So you get airbrushed out of the photos, and sort of the icing on the cake for those of us who kind of find this a bit delicious to see this comeuppance is that Trump called Mo Brooks woke.
Yes.
That's the ultimate insult here. And it's not because he wants to teach critical race theory to kindergartners. It's because he said we should move on past the 2020 election. So now woke basically means anything you want it to mean that I don't like. But it is kind of, there is kind of a racist undertone here, because woke applies generally to people who are overly sensitive or overly focused on race. Now, if you do something that Trump doesn't like, you're one of them. You're one of those people who care more about black people than white people. You're woke. And if anyone knows Mo Brooks, he is the least woke person out there on the conventional definition of woke, right?
So, you're right. I mean, but it's become the all-purpose word, right? I mean, remember when Madison Cawthorn attacked President Zelensky and he's attacking Ukraine, and he just sort of throws it, and they are embracing woke ideology. I mean, it's basically a kind of a trumped up, I don't like you, just all purpose poopy head.
Yeah, but I do think, you know, I'm just really working this out in my mind as I talk to you, which is dangerous to do on a podcast, but we're not live, so we can edit it out if it sounds stupid. That there is this racial component, you know, when, so yes, you're a poopy head, as you say, but you're a poopy head because you're like these other people who are doing this racial thing that we don't like. And in fact, you know, the one of the low moments on the Trump right, I mean, there are so many, we can spend hours on it, but one happened the night before the Russian invasion of Ukraine on Steve Bannon's own podcast. He was on with Eric Prince, and they were kind of laughing giddily about Vladimir Putin, and that they kind of liked him because he was anti-woke. So that's why they were in favor of a guy who has destroyed cities, killed thousands of civilians, and has threatened nuclear war.
Yes, but at least you don't have drag queen story hour in Moscow.
Yes, so there is that. On the one hand, you know, complete destruction and deaths of thousands. On the other hand, we don't have to look at rainbow flags.
I was thinking when you were talking about Mo Brooks very mildly saying that, okay, it's time to move on, which has, you know, resulted in the unendorsement. Obviously, it's more about the poll results, but he said, you know, we need to move on from 2020. It reminds me that he was like the guy that stopped clapping first, you know, at one of these Stalin or Kim Jong-un things where they're all like applauding and applauding, and no one wants to be the first person to stop applauding because then you get taken out. Mo Brooks stopped applauding, and it was like, you're done, you're out. This is just another reminder, though, how toxic these Trump endorsements are. I mean, I know it's in the cult. It's become this conventional wisdom that in Republican politics, this is the most valuable thing you could possibly have, to have Trump's endorsement. But number one, we're seeing around the country, it may not work. He may have a bad primary season. Number two, if you get Trump's endorsement, you are required then to say all the stupid things all the time, and you can't ever stop clapping. And then number three, it's possible that he will just unendorse you, revoke you in the most humiliating possible manner. So I would think that, once again, you know, Republicans might want to actually rethink the wisdom of crawling on your knees and pulling your forelock and kissing the ring and begging for Donald Trump's blessing.
I mean, I know you're an optimist, Charlie, no. But I think we're long past the point of the Republicans coming to that realization. I mean, after January 6th, you know, there was this nanosecond when Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, even Lindsey Graham, said enough was enough. He was responsible for this. It was reckless. It was, you know, a threat to the Constitution, to the nation. And I think they saw a glimmer of, you know, like they were hostages, and like the door opens, and like, we can make a run for it. And then all of a sudden the door closes because the base says, the problem isn't the Republican leadership as much as I think it is the Republican base.
Absolutely.
Saying, no, we want this. We want more January 6th. We want more QAnon shamans, you know, attacking Mike Pence and threatening to kill him. And so they don't have the courage of leadership, which sometimes is to challenge your followers or try to lead them in a certain direction. I know that's hard, and there is a tension between representing people and challenging them and putting them in a different place. But by, you know, going along with this, they have only fed the Republican madness. And I mean, it goes back decades, but it certainly goes back to the Tea Party. With John Boehner making accommodations there and amping up the rhetoric at that point in time, and you can, you know, after Sarah Palin's vice presidential bid, but people keep asking me, and you know the party better than I do, like, when is the fever going to break? What's going to break the fever? And I just don't. The whole run up to the war, when you have Tucker Carlson saying, I'm rooting for Putin. Why is he, you know, because he's anti-Biden, anti-Biden, and Biden's anti-Putin. I mean, it is the Republican Party has become both a cult and a complete trolling society. That's all it cares about, owning the libs, scoring points on social media with the base. You look at Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley at the
nomination
hearings. Yeah. I'm all for conservatives making conservative arguments. I love policy debates. It's what I grew up with. It's why I worked at The Nation magazine, so I could argue with people at commentary. I wanted to do that. But, you know, you can't do that with a side that's just playing stupid gotcha about Dr. Seuss and Mr. Potato Head.
Yeah, that actually almost seems now like kinder and gentler era now that they've moved on to the roars. They've sort of stepped up from kind of the mild stuff. Now it's like, you know, the most potent stuff you can peddle on the street. By the way, David, I think this is probably the first time I've been accused of being an optimist on this podcast. Actually, I think I still suffer from PTSD over the last 6 years. By the way, here's an interesting question for you. Do you remember where you and I first met? How long you and I have been talking about this stuff?
Oh,
I do.
Oh, well, let us know.
Okay. So, middle of July, 2016, you and I were sitting in the, was it the MSNBC holding room in Cleveland during the Republican National Convention that nominated Donald Trump?
Oh, yes.
And you came over and you said, I have something in the magazine tomorrow that I think you will like. And you gave me a printout of a piece with the headline, do you remember? Donald Trump and the Politics of Being an Asshole.
Oh, yes.
And I did like it. I actually, so just for people's reference, we have been doing this for a very long time. And I think that there's an advantage and a disadvantage of doing this for now almost 6 years, which is it's a graveyard of illusions. You've been through this. You've seen the patterns. You can recognize the patterns. But also, it is exhausting. Now, speaking of exhausting, and we're talking about like Dr. Seuss and Mr. Potato, and I'm serious about the kinder and gentler era, because the stuff that's being peddled right now, including on Russia, is so incredibly toxic. Let's play a little bit of a soundbite, and I apologize in advance. I'm going to try to wean myself off of Marjorie Taylor Greene soundbites, but it's an indication of where the id of the Republican Party is. And I think that people who look at the polls and say, well, you know, the vast majority of Republicans are, you know, supporting what's going on in Ukraine. Keep in mind what drives the Republican Party, you know, who the people are, who are the rock stars. So here's Marjorie Taylor Greene sharing her deep thoughts about the war.
I'll even blame people like Lindsey Graham, who is begging for war every single night on the television. These are the people that gave the Ukrainian people the false hope. And now you see Ukraine just kept poking the bear and poking the bear, which is Russia.
What?
And Russia invaded. And the truth is, and this is the hard truth to accept, there is no win for Ukraine here. Russia is being very successful in their invasion, though we hear different things on television. The things that we see and we know that are actually happening there, I don't see a way out for Ukraine.
David Korn, your thoughts. I saw you were tweeting about this.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty deplorable, as a former Democratic candidate might say. I mean, imagine blaming the Poles or the Czechs or the French or the British for the for Hitler's attack on those nations in the late 30s, early 40s.
If only the Jews would stop poking the Nazi bear.
I mean, yeah, if the Jews just got along with the Nazi government, nothing would have happened to them. Mm. There was an argument prior to the war about Ukraine alliance with the West and whether it would freak out Russia and to what degree should you care about that? Should Ukraine be totally freed to make its own decisions? Are there security concerns for Russia that should be honored? I mean, that was a debate that's been ongoing for years and, you know, was worth having and worth discussing. But while cities are being leveled, to sort of blame the Ukrainians because, you know, they poked the bear. There was nothing in that comment. And there's been, you know, very little, if you watch Fox and other places, that's blasting Putin for massacring thousands of people and destroying cities. I mean, that's where the visceral reaction, that's where the anger should be, not blaming Ukrainians. And to say the invasion has been successful and it's
very successful.
And maybe at the end of the day, the Ukrainians don't have a way out of this. And maybe they end up being conquered in some fashion by Putin and Russia. That's certainly possible. But to talk about it in this tone, I mean, and then you had Madison Cawthon calling Zelensky a thug. You've had Candace Owens, who was like the number one black supporter of Donald Trump. That's what she called herself.
And Ben Shapiro.
She still is a Ben Shapiro star.
The intellectual conservative.
Ben. Yeah, and she's out saying Ukraine's not even really a country. It was created by Russia in 1989, which is historically wrong. It's like these people are rooting for Putin. They're rooting against Ukraine. And I think this is all a product of the toxification of politics that has happened, you know, in the last 6 years with the rise of Trump. It was going in that direction. He didn't create something out of nothing, but he actually exacerbated it. But, you know, this is unfortunate in the sense that with the American public more or less coalescing behind a set of policies that Biden and the West are following, with most Americans horrified by what Putin is doing and not supportive of him, and actually inspired by Zelensky and the Ukrainians' fight for democracy, this could have been a moment in earlier years where we actually put aside some differences, you know, and agree on some big ideas about the value of democracy and the value of trying to support Ukraine. We could argue about the best ways to do that, and no doubt we would. But, you know, the Republican Party is just hell-bent on making sure there is never a consensus about what to do, whether it's about COVID, about Ukraine. And it's hard to have a country if 10, 20, 30, 40% of it says, we will not work with you. We will not join with you under any circumstances. Even if we're attacked by aliens from outer space, and Independence Day, they'd be rooting for the aliens.
Well, it depends which side Biden was on.
Yes.
So let me talk about your big scoop last week. Because I want to get to this fundamental question, which I think is fascinating, which is why you have conservatives who love Putin. Just hold that thought over here. But I want to talk about your story, which was, I think, a real bombshell. This leaked memo from the Kremlin telling the Russian media that it is essential to feature Tucker Carlson. This was March 3rd. You know, as the Russians are bombing Ukrainian cities, the Kremlin sends out talking points to state-friendly media, and, you know, at the center of it, use more Tucker Carlson. So talk to me about this amazing memo.
Yeah, and this was a series of memos. I mean, I got my hands on two, another one that came out a week later, that also encouraged them to quote Tucker Carlson on, you know, attacking Biden on inflation. You know, this is classic propaganda and disinformation. If you can use the other side to make your point, that's better. You know, it's one thing for a Russian to say Putin's great. It's another thing if you can quote an eminent American commentator saying Putin is great, and particularly if you get into these disinformation battles. I mean, we saw that on Tucker's show, he and Glenn Greenwald were promoting the Russian disinformation that Ukraine had bioweapons labs that the U.S. had been supporting. And this was one reason why the Russians say they had to go into Ukraine. In fact, you know, Tucker, on one bizarre show, was screaming, you know, they call this disinformation, but it's true. It's true. It's true. And he was totally mischaracterizing testimony that came from a State Department official earlier that day. And then what he says then gets picked up again by Russian media, with Tucker Carlson, you know, basically debunking the charge that this is disinformation. So it's incredibly useful to the Russians. Now, you know, I've known Tucker a long time, for decades. We used to do Crossfire together as guest host on that, you know, and I used to get along with him pretty well. And I, you know, think about this and all the other stuff too about him a lot. But it is possible he's entitled to his opinions, as you and I are. And if our opinion happens to be that something another country is doing is right and what we're doing, our policy, is wrong, so be it. I've felt that way at times in the past. But when this involves an illegal invasion that's killing thousands, I don't know why you wouldn't say to that other country, hey, leave me out of it. You know, this is my view. I will state my view, but I'm not your propaganda tool. Try to create some separation. At least pause for a moment and look at how your words are being used.
So he hasn't done that?
He hasn't. No, he hasn't done that at all. He refused to respond to my story. I tried many ways to get him and the top Fox press people. I mean, I reached them. I mean, I got them. They knew what the story I was working on. I, you know, sent them the portions of the memo. They didn't respond, and they, before the story went up, they haven't responded after the story went up. And he certainly hasn't used his broadcast to tell the Kremlin to knock it off, stop using me this way. So, I mean, I have a very difficult time understanding just the human calculations that go on in a situation like that, when you see yourself being used by people who are creating such devastation and you don't speak out about it.
The Russian memo that you had goes through exactly the kinds of things that Tucker Carlson is saying that they wanted to amplify. You know, that Tucker Carlson's been very critical of the United States and NATO, blaming them for unleashing the conflict in Ukraine. You know, the defiantly provocative behavior from the leadership of Western countries toward the Russian Federation and, you know, President Putin personally. They wanted to emphasize Tucker's position that Russia is only protecting its interests and security. And the memo includes a quote from Tucker. And how would the U.S. behave if such a situation developed in neighboring Mexico or Canada? And then you go through in the article what the various talking points are. But let's go to this question that we're kind of circling here. What is your best theory about what Tucker is thinking? Because I have to say that I was on a show the other day with somebody who was pushing the line, well, you know, this is Russian compromising people or Russian money is doing this. And I'm shaking my head. I didn't have a chance to answer, but I was, you know, my reaction was, I think you're totally missing the point here. Tucker is not paid off. Tucker has plenty of money. They don't have naked pictures of him. That's not what it is. There's a certain, I don't even know if you could use the word, he believes this shit, but there is a reason why he is doing this.
Right.
What do you think? I mean, is it just the oppositionalism? Because he doesn't need to do this to get big ratings, right? He doesn't need to do this.
No, I don't think he does. And I don't think he's being blackmailed. I don't think he's being bought off. I agree with you on that. I see no evidence of that. That's just far too risky for anyone to do when you're already making tens of millions of dollars a year doing this on your own. I think there are kind of overlapping explanations, none of which are fully satisfying. And one, you mentioned oppositionalism. I think because he saw the Democrats and Biden being anti-Putin, he wants to be anti-Putin.
Right.
You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friends. Because Putin's giving Biden a hard time, he wants to be in favor of Putin. That's the trolling explanation here, that, you know, this is the culture of the right now. We have to be against anything that Biden
caused. But there's genuine admiration.
But they, I was getting
the
to the...
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, so I mean, that, I said that, that's one. I said they were overlapping. Yeah. You know, I don't know what you call that, a cultural, sociological explanation. I think there is an ideological component to this. I think, you know, people on the right, some of them, in the particularly in the alt-right and the far-right, have looked at Putin as a champion, a defender of white conservative Christianity, whether it's beating up on a Muslim terrorist or separatist elsewhere, or it's being, as Bannon talked about, being anti-woke. And they see him as a strong presence for what they would call Western values in a certain way, even though he, you know, he comes from more from the East, right? And I, so I do think that you look at their attachment to Viktor Orban in Hungary. CPAC had scheduled its conference there that they had to cancel because of the war. But there is this affinity for these post-communist, anti-immigrant, anti-woke authoritarians of Eastern Europe. So I think there is something there, too.
What is it they most like? I keep coming back to the anti-gay policies, which is kind of interesting. You know, that they have, and you see this in the rhetoric that you're getting from the Josh Hawleys of the world, or, you know, they're pushing back more and more on all this. But what is it about Orban? Is it shutting down the media? Is it attacking the universities? Is it banning, you know, the depictions of gay people? Is it, you know, is it the anti-immigration stance that they've taken? I mean, what's the secret sauce that would make a Tucker Carlson actually go to Hungary and imply that maybe the United States should be more like Hungary, which is like something that I never would have thought an American conservative would be saying?
I don't have, to me, is a satisfying answer to that question. They certainly seem to care more about a cultural, political, civil war here in the United States, whether it's the age-old railing against the liberal elite, the academic elite, the people at Harvard, and then it's merged into railing against wokeness and BLM, and they tend to put a nationalist, anti-immigration, populist cast to this as well. And then you look at someone like Orban, and it's like, yeah, he's beating up on the gays. He's telling, you know, the liberal media to go to hell. And he's going after the same enemies, the same type of enemies that we are identifying and maybe somewhat orchestrating here in the United States, we being people on the right. And then, you know, and then you put that under the umbrella of the Trump cult, which is led by a guy who has this personal affection for Vladimir Putin. In 2007, he writes a letter to him saying, I'm a big fan. In 2013, when he holds the Miss Universe contest there, he puts out a tweet saying, will Putin come? Will he be my new best friend? Putin was already a murderous thug by this point in time. And as Michael Isikoff and I, you know, show in our book, Russian Roulette, when Trump is in Moscow for the Miss Universe contest in 2013, he spends his 36 hours there asking over and over again to have a meeting with Putin. He wants to be like Putin. And the other day, talk about strange bedfellows, Charlie, you know, how the Trump years have brought us together across ideological lines. I was doing an interview with John Bolton, who, who in decades had passed, he and I would never agree on anything. But I asked him about Trump and his affinity for Putin. And he said it always puzzled him. But if you look at it, it's not just Putin. It's Orban, it's Erdogan, it's Xi in China, Kim Jong-un in North Korea, you know, and he said all he can think of is that he wants to be like these guys who get to do whatever they want. You know, we know he doesn't care about democracy. He didn't care about in 2016 when Russia attacked. He didn't care about it in 2020. He wants the power and the thrill of being one of the big guys. So he sets the tone by admiring and defending Putin for the last 6 years. And that creates a permission structure for the alt-right, for ideological reasons, for Tucker Carlson, for trolling reasons, to be Putin-friendly or Putin-supportive.
So what would happen if we had a Trump 2.0? Well, what would happen if he became president? What would that mean for the Western Alliance and for Vladimir Putin?
Well, first I want to say, you know, the three things that Trump cares most about in life overall are revenge, revenge, and revenge. I mean, you think about the scene in Godfather where Michael Corleone takes care of all the enemies on the same day when there's a baptism. I mean, Trump would be only motivated by settling scores. So, you know, what would that mean in terms of, you know, the Ukraine or anything like that? It would all be filtered, you know, through settling scores and part of the score settling, which he tried to do with Obama, would be undoing anything that Biden did, right? So if Biden strengthened the NATO alliance, an alliance that Trump, according to John Bolton and others, wanted to blow up in his second term, he would blow it up. He would do whatever he can not to be a leader. He would accommodate Putin wherever we are with the war at that point in time. He would also, I don't want to be overly paranoid, but he would use whatever power the federal government grants him, or I should say abuse whatever power he could, to go after his political enemies, whether it's through...
Oh, I don't think that's paranoid. I mean, this is a guy who was saying lock her up before he got elected. Yeah. So,
but whether through the IRS, through Justice Department investigations, certainly, you know, we'll see. You know, particularly if the Republicans win back the House this coming November, or if they had control via the body with a second Trump presidency, you know, 27 different investigations of Hunter Biden, investigations of the media, investigations of Hillary Clinton, Uranium One. They're just going to go back through everything again. And of course, the Ukraine conspiracy to throw the election to Hillary in 2016, which didn't happen.
So what I think is fascinating about this is that short term, I agree with you that, look, Vladimir Putin could win a lot of battles in Ukraine. It's going to be horrific. It will be terrible. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. I can't imagine that ultimately he will, quote unquote, win to use the analogy that we've used on this show before, Ukraine is the porcupine that that the python is trying to ingest, and that doesn't work out well. And I think he's going to remain a pariah for a very long time. I don't know how long, because we know how short people's attention spans are. But the one thing that can deliver him the strategic victory that seems impossible right now, I think, is a Trump presidency. That yep. Trump could make him an unpariah, whatever the opposite of pariah is, embrace him. And look, guys like Putin think about this. There's no question in my mind, and I know that some people might think I'm reaching on this, but I don't think that I am. Because Republicans and Trump keep talking about the appearance of weakness. That Joe Biden was weak, he was weak, and that's why Vladimir Putin decided to go in. I think there's some truth to that, but one of the ways that Biden was weak in Putin's eyes was because Donald Trump never conceded the election. Donald Trump and his supporters have never acknowledged the legitimacy of the Biden presidency. January 6th had to look in Vladimir Putin's eyes as a moment of maximum division and weakness in the American political system, and probably did factor into his calculations. So January 6th, I don't think, and I'll get your take on this, is not irrelevant to what's happening right now. And Putin is taking the signals from Trump world, and he does think that perhaps they represent a larger segment of the American public opinion than maybe the polls would suggest at the moment. What do you think?
I think that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about it too much, but I do think that going back to 2016, Putin saw a divided America politically and tried to exacerbate those divisions with the side goal of helping to elect Donald Trump. And one of the strategic intentions of the Russian attack on the 2016 election was, assuming that Hillary Clinton would win, which everybody assumed she would win, that she would win a very messy, divisive fight and would be a weaker president, which would help Putin, since she had always been a Secretary of State, very harsh in challenging him on democracy within Russia. She had made many statements that drove him crazy, and he had accused her of basically riling up protest movement to him within Russia. So we do know that part of his thinking is, what can I do to keep America divided? And that's good for me. If they're divided, if they're having problems with their democracy, they can't challenge me as much. So fast forward to, 2024, should Trump become president again, I think he would assume we would be in a similar position. And if you look at January 6th, indeed, that does show to the rest of the world. And remember, they see the headlines, they see the pictures. It looks like American democracy is falling apart. A country in that state, he has to, figure, will be less solid in leading the Western alliance and confronting him. They'll be busy dealing with stuff in their own backyard. So in some ways, I don't think the argument that Biden looked weak is why he did this.
Yeah.
I don't think Biden looked weak. I think America looked weak because of January 6th. And that was not obviously Biden's doing. That was Trump's doing. Part of Trump's agenda was to weaken American democracy, because that got in the way of his own plans.
So let's talk about disinformation, because one of the interesting things about some of the things you've been writing about is it gives you a glimpse of the Putin propaganda machine. And I think that Americans might underestimate the power of that within Russia, because the Russians, the majority of Russians, at least based on what I'm seeing, believe the lies that Vladimir Putin is saying, are supporting the war. And, this is the product of 10 years of disinformation. So in your piece, in the memo that you wrote about, one of the sections entitled "Victory in the Information War," the Russian journalists are told to report things like, well, the Ukrainian military is collapsing, the Kyiv government is guilty of war crimes, Moscow is the victim of a massive Western anti-Russia propaganda operation. Journalists are told to raise questions about Ukraine's President Zelensky's state of mind, suggest he's not really in charge of Ukraine, push the fact there's a law that makes it a crime to impede all of this. A lot of this is this alternative reality. And it strikes me that we can understand this differently now than we might have in 2016. In 2016, we were so much younger then, weren't they? And we're so much older now. And I just can't help but feel the echoes of just watching. This is what a complete alternative reality propaganda universe looks like. And it's much more recognizable now, especially because all you need to do is sort of pivot your head and you see it on, you know, on Fox News when Tucker Carlson's show comes on.
Yeah, well, we have the big lie here.
Right.
There are tens of millions of Americans who believe Donald Trump's big lie about the 2020 election. And that's an alternative reality. You know, we see silly trucker convoys that make it look bizarre, QAnon rallies that make it look really bizarre. But when you look at the big number, there are lots of people out there who aren't wearing silly hats who believe Donald Trump's lies, and you can't convince them otherwise. So reality distortion is something that's a problem everywhere, and we can see it working in our own country, you know, with our own communities and neighbors. I mean, I want to cite or give props to a piece that we put up today, Mother Jones. People can go to motherjones.com, that was written by a resident of St. Petersburg. And we're protecting this person's name for obvious reasons, but he or she writes about how weird it is in St. Petersburg in Russia to live in this alternative reality where people, this person knows, deny that the war is going on. And even in St. Petersburg in Moscow, Russians do have access to information that would keep them somewhat informed. That's a little less true in other parts of the country. And this person is an educated person and part of the elite of St. Petersburg, and is, I'm not saying that they are astounded by this, but they report just the eeriness of living in a, you know, in a city now and being out and about with fellow Russians who are denying that bombs are being dropped. So I would encourage people to write the story. It's beautifully written and it's very troubling. But we've heard in the last, you know, couple of weeks, multiple stories over and over again of people in the Ukraine calling their relatives in Russia,
your parents, stories,
brothers and sisters, saying, "We're being attacked. We're, you know, I've had to leave my home. I've seen apartment buildings destroyed. My city is gone." And they go, "No, it's not. No, there's no war. There's a military operation going on to liberate you guys, and we're handing out food there. But there's no destruction." And they go, I see this, and people say, "I don't believe it." You know, there are some things, you know, that are so horrible that it's hard to believe. You know, there are tens of millions of Americans who wouldn't believe that Russia attacked the American election in 2016 and had an impact on our own democracy, maybe too horrible to believe. There are people who won't believe that Obama was born in Hawaii, despite evidence put right in front of them. And so, you know, there are people who don't believe that climate change is happening. It's really tough to have, you know, not the Russia's democracy, but what I'm talking about here at home, we talk about reality distortion. It's hard to have a democracy if you can't accept basic facts.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that... what an indictment that really dealing with this disinformation is really a central part of our politics right now. You can't even talk about American politics without talking about the role of this reality distortion field that is put out by the folks who peddle disinformation. So the story you're talking about has the headline, "This Troubled Silence. In Russia, we don't talk about war or politics. Putin, what's he got to do with any of this?" And the subhead is, "Things are quiet here in St. Petersburg. Weirdly, horrendously quiet. Like there isn't a war on at all." This is just, it is so creepy. Okay, so one last thing. Let's sort of double back to where we started on some of the things that are going on. Your thoughts about the way that the Supreme Court hearings are playing out. I have to admit that, and again, I'm not going to say that I'm surprised. I just had read so much commentary about how Republicans were told, "Don't play the race card. Don't make this about race. Don't do any of these things." And on day one of the questioning, the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee just blew right past it. I mean, you know, Ted Cruz, there's just no subtlety whatsoever. Tells me that really the Republicans, people like Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton and Hawley and Blackburn, have just decided this is not something to worry about, that they are going to play all of these things, screw the dog whistles, they're going right for the foghorns. And they think that these are, once again, the kinds of wedge issues that I wouldn't have thought they were since, like, I don't know, what, 1967? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I am totally unsurprised. Yeah. You know, in our internal conversations at Mother Jones as we got ready for the hearings, I said over and over again, they're going to make this about race. They can't not do this. They can't resist. You know, they may not attack her directly and say she shouldn't be on the court. I mean, they'll vote against her, but they may not go against her, but they're going to use this as an occasion for the flying wedge, I call it that.
Yeah.
And so I've watched some of the hearings, and you see Ted Cruz start haranguing her for being on the board of a private school in the D.C. area that had some anti-racism books on the curriculum. What the hell that has to do with anything other than just him as a sort of peacock strutting his feathers to show I am fighting wokeness and critical race theory everywhere I can. That's what I am. I'm a champion of this. It turns out, I saw that Forbes reported that some of those very same books are on the curriculum of the school that he sends his own children to.
Oops.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. And Josh Hawley raising questions about whether she has gone light in terms of sentencing sex criminals or pedophiliacs. You know, it sounds like a cliche to say this, but would they be doing this if she were, you know, if she was a white candidate? You know, we know the answer here. So
they want her to be the face of liberal democratic wokeness. They see her as the perfect poster child, the perfect foil. They want to do that. The Republican National Committee puts out that tweet with her picture, you know, KBJ, and then crosses it out and writes CRT. I mean, you know, they're not even trying to be subtle about all of
this. Yeah, and Tucker Carlson was talking about how she, but then he's taking like the opposite line, like she's more of a white liberal. She's not, has nothing in common with a black street rapper. You know, right, it's like, whoa, rapper. I mean, so what's the angle on that? You know, you and I might disagree on to some extent. I know that our friend Stuart Stevens is with me on this now. I think the Republican Party, going back to 1960, 64, has played the race card. It's always been essential, and they do it sometimes more, sometimes less, but it's always been baked into the cake. And, you know, when you thought the election of Obama, that maybe we were moving to a different phase, it actually awoke the anti-wokeness and made racial resentments even more important to the Republican Party. And, you know, Trump's racism from his promotion of birtherism and everything else he's done, you know, became not a bug, but a feature.
Well, I agree. And here's where I disagree. I don't think this was inevitable. I think that there was an alternative for the party at some point, but that was the road not taken, because we now see what the road was that was taken. And so all of those things that had been the recessive genes have just flared up in such a dramatic fashion that they're doing. I have to say that she's handling this, I use the term, you know, preternatural calm, which I hope nobody thinks of as pejorative, because, you know, she is sitting there and, you know, watching these bad faith attacks and really understands how important it is for her to keep her cool. And I think that she's done it, and, you know, systematically trying to explain to Tom Cotton how the sentencing works, the complexity of all of this. But Tom Cotton also knows that the complexity gets lost if you make the charge loud enough and repeatedly enough.
Well, she's no Brett Kavanaugh, that's for sure. And she did give Cruz this look yesterday
that was
just daggers. And then she just very calmly explained her answer. I do not know her personally. I know people who do, and they just, you know, speak in just tremendously wonderful terms about her. I mean, what she's doing the last 2 days is showing what we call a judicial temperament, right? Which is important. So my hat's off to her. I'm not sure I could treat Lindsey Graham and Tom Cotton and Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley with the surface level respect she has done so. But, you know, that's what you want from a judge. So it's to her credit.
Yes. After 11 hours of being asked, can you define a woman? Are babies racist? Could you rate your faith on a scale of 1 to 10? And then Tom Cotton, you sympathize with this fentanyl drug dealer. At some point, you would say, you know, Senator, with all due respect, just fuck off. I mean, it's just, I don't know. This is why we'll never be on the Supreme Court.
Or at long last, sir, have you no decency?
Yeah. Well, okay, that I think would not be inconsistent with the judicial temperament. I don't think so. So, David Corn, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. David is the Washington Bureau Chief at Mother Jones and analyst for MSNBC. He also writes the newsletter Our Land. You can find his work at davidcorn.com. Great to talk with you again, David.
Thank you. Now I can check this off my bucket list.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.